Oh, hello, everybody. You are listening to the Voice of Vashon, 101.9 in downtown Vashon. You're listening to The Clatch, and I am Linda Nygaard. I'll be your host today. And with me in the studio, in the Jean Bosch studio downtown, is our renowned co-host, Susan McCabe.
Hello.
Hi, Susan. Today, we are really lucky. We have a couple of special guests in the studio. We have Miss Deb Sheehan, a formerly incarcerated woman, and her son, Dylan. Hi, Deb.
Hello.
Hi, Dylan.
Hello.
Welcome. They're sitting here waiting for us to ask them some questions, and we're going to do that in a little while. Deb is going to share her story with us about what happened to her and what she learned in prison and how life is afterwards. But first, we're going to talk about some other things, and then we'll come back to Deb. Okay? Also, I'd like to give a shout-out to Dove. For those of you who don't know, Dove, D-O-V-E, is Vashon's answer to domestic violence. The initials stand for Dignity, Opportunity, Voice, and Empowerment. And they are Vashon's domestic violence and sexual assault agency, and they provide survivor services, prevention, education, and community programs. And they're directed by Heidi Jackson, who does a terrific job keeping things all together and helping our community. And today, Heidi is having a coffee clatch at the office with her team. And they're all sitting around having a cup of coffee and listening to us live because this issue is very dear to their hearts as well. So hello, Heidi, and thank you for joining us. We look forward to chatting with you, too. So normally we do a COVID check-in at this point. And I guess let's do that today. Susan, anything new going on with COVID in your world?
Well, you know, I go back and forth on the mask thing.
Yeah.
One morning I might wake up and think, oh my God, I'm afraid I'm going to get sick. So I put my mask on when I go to the grocery store, but I don't put my mask on when I go somewhere else. It kind of depends.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's for everyone else too. I think it's confusing.
Well,
what do we do next?
Yeah. I'm still pretty regimented with my mask when I'm in public, but like now I'm not, or if you know you're with three or four people, I think it's fine. The thing that scares me is China, and their crematoriums are full and overflowing.
Well, yeah.
And you know, they're talking about millions of people infected.
Well, China is a huge country. I used to do marketing and PR there, and I got great kudos because my numbers were outstanding for the people that I reached.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of thousands of people, because it's such a hugely populated
right.
country. So,
percentage-wise.
Percentage-wise, it's not surprising that millions of people might be dying.
But still,
there are so many.
You know, the crematoriums, they're full. I mean, that's a lot of people. And I just remember how contagious it really is. And there's lots of flights back and forth and all of that. So anyway, I'm concerned and I'm still wearing my mask.
So you're concerned that China is going to be reinfecting us. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah, kind of. Like, they're not being very honest about what it is they're experiencing. And, you know, they just opened up everything over there because they had such huge protests.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what the answer is. I sure don't, but I'm not going to China anytime soon. I do know that. So, well, let's just get to it. What do you think?
I think it's a good idea.
So I'm going to tell our audience out here that Deb has a lived experience and lived advantage over the rest of us in that she was incarcerated in Washington Correction
Center for Women.
Which is near Gig Harbor, for over 5 years. And her work release came in January of 2019. Since that time, she has finished her degree while working full-time, graduated in June 2022 with a Bachelor of Arts, majoring in Law and Justice with a minor in Political Science. And she currently works as a paralegal for Dubois Levias Law Group, which is a family law firm in Seattle. Amanda Dubois, the founder of the firm, also started Civil Survival Project with Tara Simmons. And if you don't know Tara Simmons, she's a formerly incarcerated individual as well. And she's been elected to office in the United States. She's currently a Washington State Representative, just reelected to her second term. And further, just one more little tidbit here. Deb is a member of the Lived Experience Advisory Team, which is facilitated by Jeannie Darnielle, who is the assistant to the Secretary of Prisons in Washington State. Jeannie just retired earlier this year from being a state senator after 20 years or so, more than that, I think, to become the first person to run the Women's Prison Division. And the purpose of the team is to discuss gender differences and to advise the Department of Corrections on those issues. So welcome, Deb.
Welcome.
That's an impressive, what do we call that? We don't call it a resume, but that there's a lot in there.
It's a great story.
Isn't it?
Yeah. It's really fascinating.
Well, I think let's start at the beginning. Let's start, tell me what happened and how you ended up in the Women's Correction Center.
Okay. My life was pretty hectic. I think we all see things differently. I was feeling a little bit of stress at home and mm-hmm. at work. I had a pretty hostile work environment, not so happy marriage, and I started mm-hmm. gambling. And then I worked for a law firm at that time, and I mm-hmm. had taken money from the law firm. And eventually, it wasn't one of those things in my mind that I ever thought I was going to get away with. I did eventually get caught. Mm-hmm. It was 9 months after I lost my job, and they started the investigation before they did the surprise of coming and finally arresting me.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to, I got an exceptional sentence because I had a very, very bad public defender. And mm-hmm. my son can even speak to that. It was a horrible situation.
Well, tell me about that, because we touched on that briefly in our phone conversation about specifically what he did.
Well, that's a whole, you have overzealous prosecutors and overworked public defenders who mm-hmm. aren't necessarily committed to what they're doing. And so he had told me all along, hindsight, if I could have afforded to get out on bail, I wouldn't have kept him. But
right.
he had told me all along, like, oh, he was doing this and doing that. But every time we'd meet, I'd have to rehash why I was even there all over again.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually he talked me into pleading guilty. And so I did do that because he said, they're not going to offer you a plea deal. So let's just, and it doesn't make sense to go to trial because you admit you're guilty. So plead guilty. And then we'll go in front of the judge for sentencing and put our argument together then.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I said, okay, I'm trusting him. He gave me things to do. And he said, this is what he's going to do. He said, I'll have family members talk. I had probably 15 to 20 family members and friends there.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came to the time of the hearing, the prosecutor puts on this like whole half hour plus presentation that made me look like a monster.
Mm.
And he gets in front of them, calls me by the wrong name and was corrected by the prosecutor, speaks for 5 minutes, basically saying that she's cooperated, so she should get the low end. And that was it. And so based on that, and they asked for an exceptional sentence for no reason, because the whole system is kind of, they asked for an exceptional sentence and got it of 9. So I went, mm-hmm. I got 9 years. Where majority of the people doing exactly what I did, same amount of money, get 3.
And
I got 9.
Were the majority of those people men?
No, even some of the women in the prison I was in that did the exact same. One of my really great friends now, she went there and she only got 3 years. And it has a lot to do with, first it was a law firm. So I know that attorney was bugging the prosecutor constantly.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have a pretty inept public defender that doesn't do anything or even justify, there's no justification of what I did. What I did was wrong, and I expected to be punished without
mm-hmm.
a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
I just expected to be punished fairly,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and I had this issue that, so the prosecutor can also decide how long they give you or how they break up your charges. They can give you one charge or they can break up every single little incident into a charge. And that's what they did.
And that's what they, so you had numerous charges.
Yeah, it amounted to like 24 charges. And so the way they can do that on the sentencing grid line is that it starts out like 0 to 3 prior point. I had no mm. prior criminal history.
Mm-hmm.
And so they could do your prior criminal history, prior felonies, add up to make your sentence bigger. And so what that means is, say there's 0 to 3. You've had 0 to 3 prior felonies before now.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking, I've had 0. I should be in the low end, which is like up to, I think, 1.5, 2 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it was something low. No, what they do, the way it can be broke down to, is they'll take the first 2 charges to the 0 to 3. The rest of the charges now put me in 9 plus
oh,
the max.
Wow.
So they were able to give me 7 years on that and add two more based on the RCW.
Mm-hmm. And that's because there were 24 different charges?
Because the way she decided to break it down. And because the system's not right. And the system, because the system's not, I was under, this is another room we're talking about how ignorant I was before this whole incident, is I was under the assumption that I would, no matter what, be in the zero range because I have no prior.
Right.
Because all of these are one incident. All of these are on one thing that I'm being brought to for now. But no, they're able to break that apart to make it look like the first few incidents, they can break it apart. The first few charges can be the 0 to 3 range. Now, all of a sudden, the rest of them have you all the way up to the 9+, which is the max. It's just the way
devastated.
The system works. Yeah. I mean, and even the RCW, the 4 exceptional sentences, it's 56 different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I can pretty much, anybody I want exceptional, I can put them in there.
Would it be fair to say that the system with those multiple charges is set up to create the longest possible sentences under any circumstances?
Correct.
And of course, the first question that comes to my mind is, who's benefiting from those long sentences? What is there a rationale behind that? And if so, do you have any idea what that rationale is?
Here's my rationale of it, the way I believe the system's set up, is if you look at most of the judges, they've usually been prosecutors or somewhere in that type of office somewhere along.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the prosecutors, given that much leeway, a lot of it changed to where the prosecutors had a lot more leeway when it changed so that we don't have the parole system and they have mandatory guidelines, all of that, took all that off of the judge's hands and gave it to the prosecutors. And so those prosecutors now are trying to get into being a judge or get into political office.
Sure.
And so when
sure.
they look like they're tough on crime or look what I did, you know, then it just makes them look better and they think it's going to look better in the public's eye.
I have a question. Did I hear you correctly? Did you say we do not have a parole system?
Correct.
In Washington?
Correct.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
maybe they're trying
to make
it come back
on that. But. Yeah, there. I believe there is legislation proposed in this session.
Mm-hmm.
To allow a parole system.
Okay.
But it exists for two different kinds of crimes. And is it sex crimes? And I'm not remembering this correctly.
Okay. Well, we'll have to look that up.
Yeah, it's a very limited parole system, essentially non-existent.
Yeah. Well, so there are a couple things too. Dylan.
Yes.
As Deb's son. What happened when they came to get your mom, and how old were you?
So my experience was a little bit different in just that I was older. So it was on my 21st birthday.
On your birthday.
So I wake up in the morning pounding on the door, and you know everyone else was at work. Mom was at work. And so I go downstairs and open the door, and you know I open it, and there's no one there. I'm like, well, what? That's weird. And so I peek around the corner, and there's about 6 police officers that have their hands on the guns. And so my first thought was that there's someone in the neighborhood or something extremely dangerous, you know, like obviously what my mom did was wrong, but it wasn't necessarily dangerous to the point where we needed armed men at my house.
Mm-hmm.
But so, you know, then they introduced themselves and said who they were looking for. And, you know, not necessarily fortunately, but luckily we had already had the idea that this was going to happen since she was being investigated for so long before that. So, you know, I had time to internally prepare myself and be ready for that moment. You know, obviously still not ideal. I didn't want that to happen by any means, but at least in that time, you know, I kind of realized that it wasn't all just about me either because my little brother was still there. And so you just kind of realized like, this is an opportunity. I don't have time to, you know, dwell on it or, you know, be sad. We got to kind of pick up the pieces and keep moving and be there for her and for my little brother. And so that's kind of how I perceived it and my outlook as all in all, it was as much as I didn't want her there, it was an opportunity for me to grow up and be a better person for everyone around myself and in our family. So I guess that was kind of at least the experience that I had in a whole, at least.
It must have seemed like a long time.
It did, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. Deb, let's go back to you for a second. And I would like to know what it was like, what you felt, what you heard, what you saw when you first got there. How did that affect you? being, you know, I should preface that with that you and I have talked about ignorance of the system. And I suppose ignorant, uninformed, I don't know what the right word is, but you didn't have any idea.
No.
What you were headed for.
No, I did not. And I don't come from a family of people getting in trouble and going to jail and that kind of stuff. Yeah. So I wasn't familiar with how any of it worked. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember my first night getting arrested and, you know, I'm in jail and that was around like an environment that I am not used to. Like I say, I come from a legal background. A family doesn't get in trouble. I've always done the right thing. And so this was completely out of my element.
Yeah.
And I remember just kind of like breaking down. I remember being on the phone to my husband and going, I was crying and going, I can't do this. Mm-hmm. I can't do this. And he's like, just make friends. And I'm like, I don't want to. Yeah. You know, I was just like freaking. It was the first couple weeks was a real shock. I was in county jail for 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And actually going to prison was a relief. County jail's worse than prison.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely worse than prison.
You might want to distinguish the two for folks who are ignorant of the system. Yeah, difference between county jail and prison.
Okay. County jail is basically where you're held while your case is ongoing until a distinction is made, until you're found guilty, innocent, whatever the situation may be, till you're sentenced, I should say. There is, with the exception of, if you get less than a year of jail, if you get less than a year of time, you serve it in jail.
Mm-hmm.
So say you go and you're there within the first few weeks, you get sentenced to 8 months, then you serve it all in jail. If it's a year and a day, which a lot of people fought for because they didn't want to stay in county jail, if it's a year and a day, you automatically go to prison.
Wow.
And so that's where the difference is. Yeah,
interesting.
It's a completely different, like, I believe me, I've learned a lot in this whole process. And so then when you go to prison, it's different where you get your own room, or not your own room. I mean, you share a room, but it's kind of a different, a little more than when I was in county jail. I was in with 42 other women in bunks in one big open room.
Oh, really? Wow.
And it was just, there's no real relaxing. Mm-hmm. There's no real any of that. You're constantly on guard because you don't know. I mean, it's all different people from different cultures. I mean, people coming in who are coming off of drugs and throwing up. So I just did the best I could there and became a unit worker. And all the officers ended up liking me because I did what I needed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember a time of a girl coming in and me helping defend her because someone had read what her probable cause statement said. And they had read what her probable cause statement said, and it made it look like she had let her boyfriend abuse her child. Well, you don't know the circumstances. I know what my probable cause said, and that wasn't even close
to
accurate.
Yeah.
And so they were making her cry, just bullying her and bullying her. And I went over there and said, no, this is not happening. You back off. And I got along with these girls. And all of a sudden they were like, this one main leader one was trying to turn on me and doesn't realize that's not working. So the officer knew what I was like and knew what she was like and got her taken out. But I don't believe in bullying. I don't care. I don't know her situation.
Right.
I don't know what happened.
Right.
And I wasn't going to allow it.
So that's the experience in county jail. You're
correct.
Locked up with a whole bunch of other women.
Correct.
Contrast that to prison. So when you go to prison, you said you're in a room or is it a cell?
Well, they call them cells, and I can't speak for the men's prison because I understand they're a little harsher than the women's. But just for example, when you're in maximum or medium, which is when you're over 4 years, you have to be in, start out in maximum, go to medium when there's a room available. And then after 4 years, you can go up to minimum, which is your heel, which is the whole different environment. But the first in maximum and medium, you're two to a room. And you get your own, you know, with the maximum, you don't get your own key. The officer has to let you in and out from a control board. But when you get over to medium, you get your own key and you go in and out of your room. But yes, you still have a time scale. Like you can only be out these certain time of the day. You can only, in maximum, you actually have a toilet and the sink in your room with you. In medium on, it's outside your room.
So you don't have a bathroom in your room?
No, you are, but you're able to
go
the bathroom unless
yeah.
it's a major lockdown and they won't let you if there's something going on.
Yeah.
But you can't do it then.
You touched a little bit on a subject that's very dear to me, and that's domestic violence. And there was the young woman who was accused of the one that you were in jail with. What about domestic violence and women in prison?
Well, there is, the statistics on domestic violence women, that's one of the differences between women in prison versus men in prison.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big majority of women in prison that are there for domestic violence situations. And as we spoke for someone I was on participating in clemency hearing for,
mm-hmm.
The statistics show that 90% of the women that are in prison for killing somebody, killing a man, is usually due to domestic violence and have been abused by that man prior.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a huge part of it. Like the codependency, the domestic violence is a big issue.
So women go to prison because they killed their abuser.
Correct.
Many times.
Correct.
And there's no defense for that.
They're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you have the justice, the failing with the justice system.
Right.
Is that it depends on the prosecutor and how they want to look at it. I mean, like in this situation I'm telling you about, this person that I went to, she's been in prison for 33 years.
Yes, do tell us about that.
Okay. Well, and she, her husband, she was from the Philippines. She wasn't the mail order bride, but he had one where he went over to pick up. He's 40 years older than her. Mm. He went over to pick up his bride. She said no. He realized how old he was and didn't do it. Well, my friend, she had already been ousted by her family because she was raped when she was younger and got pregnant and had a son out of wedlock. And so she went ahead and said, yes, I'll go with you, even though he's 40 years older than her. So he came back over here and the violence started almost immediately. Like he was he has a idea of what a Filipino woman should behave like,
oh,
you know,
sure,
you know, just had that kind of impression. And he abused her they had two boys. There's many times where he had threatened to kill her. One time where they were driving towards a train and they were fighting, he goes, I'm just going to kill us all. And he was going to run into the train until she grabbed the steering wheel and pulled it. And that's just one of the many situations. But also she felt like she couldn't leave him because he would say, if you leave me, I'm going to kill you and the boys.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just escalated to that. And she didn't feel like, based on her upbringing, based on the way it is with women, especially back then, I mean, we're talking late 80s. Is that you don't tell people about it. No one's going to believe you anyway. You know, you just accept it. And so she did, and she never left. And slept in separate rooms. And he came in one night and raped her. She didn't want to do it. She kept saying, no, he raped her. And she had to get up for work the next day. So she got up afterwards, went and showered, went and laid on the couch, dressed and ready to go to work because, you know, she was already traumatized. Well, she woke up and could smell like this smell. And she ended up having to go outside to get air because she couldn't breathe. But she didn't know what she was smelling. When she walks out the door gets locked behind her. And in that situation, then she's trying to get back in and can't, runs to the neighbors, and the neighbors look out with her and the house is burning down.
Mm.
And she got charged with that, even though there was no...
With the kids in it.
Correct.
Yeah.
So the husband and the kids died in the fire, and she got charged aggravated murder for all three of them. Even though it was proven the only gasoline on her was on the bottom of her shoe where she walked across it to get outside. But he had it all over him, his clothing and everything.
And so what is your position with her? What are you doing for her?
So she was brought before the clemency board in December, and we're continuing it out till the prosecutor can be there. But so I testified at her clemency because I knew her while I was in prison. I worked with her for 5 years in correctional industries in the sewing department. And I knew her as a person. And I knew like I have said before, is that there's very few people that bring you comfort in your life, and she's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it just is sad.
And she's 76 years old.
Correct.
Yeah.
And my question as you're telling this story, Deb, is what about this story is fairly typical regarding those women who 90% of whom have been given either life sentences or dramatic sentences for murdering their abusers? What is it about this case that speaks to the rest of those? Okay. What's typical?
I think what's typical to me on this is how the justice system handled it. You know, I feel like they get narrow focused on they feeling like, okay, kids died. Mm-hmm. So there has to be somebody found responsible for it. And they almost get like blinders on seeing the facts of the case. Mm-hmm. Like they want to, even the prosecutor, even at this point, even in her, still was arguing, you know, that no, she's guilty. She was found guilty. I think that the thing that this shows to every domestic violence that goes in front of the court system, well, not every, I mean, obviously the majority, I should say, is that they always feel if someone died, someone should be responsible. Mm-hmm. And they don't see, for women, I don't feel that they get, I don't know what the statistics on the men being found for domestic violence. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't speak to that. But I just feel as far as the women go, they just don't get it through the legal system because it has a hard time saying that she didn't have any involvement in it.
Yeah.
I think that that's the problem.
Well, and it makes me wonder, too, if women are murdering or killing their abusers, number one, the self-defense idea does not apply simply because they generally aren't going to kill them in a situation where they're actually being attacked.
Correct.
Is that correct? And so it is viewed then as premeditated.
Correct.
Which is not necessarily what happens when men are on trial for murdering their domestic partners.
Correct. I think that just is more emotional. It happens mm-hmm. right away. Where, especially like in her situation, I mean, you're gasoline poured inside the house and she's outside the house. It makes her look guilty without looking at the facts of it.
A deadbolt.
Correct.
So she couldn't have locked it
correct.
From the outside. Yeah.
So there's just so many factual things that if they had paid attention to that,
mm-hmm.
but I think you're absolutely right. It's not usually a crime of passion where it happens right away. I think those are probably domestic violence situations where they kind of get away with it.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it seems like, in fact, you've told me that women are treated much differently in the system than men are. Mm-hmm. Can you address some of those differences?
I think for women, sometimes it's a lot more humiliating because of some of the things that they have to go through. And one of them to me is that stands out the most, that's the most humiliating to me, was the strip searches.
Mm. And so when did they do that? Did they do that ad hoc or was it?
No, it would be. Whenever you had a visit,
mm-hmm.
so if you had a visit or they would have events, if you had events, anytime you come in contact with anybody outside of the prison that doesn't live there, like a family member or that. Mm, and okay. I was also on what's called an outside crew where we went to CJTC and did cleaning. And so every single day we come back from work, we had to get strip searched. So it's anytime you're dealing
every
with
day.
Anybody that can come and go except for mm-hmm. the officers.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever get used to that? I mean, do you get used to that? Does it just become a matter of fact?
For me, it did because it was compartmentalized.
Yeah.
The issue the majority of the time for women, too, is if you're on your period and no matter what, you have to take all that stuff out, do whatever, even if you're sounding disgusting, if you have a heavy flow, doesn't matter. I mean, I know the officers are enjoying it, but it's still degrading. It's still humiliating to be standing there bending over, spreading your cheeks, and having blood run down your legs.
Right. Like, it's just awful
to even
think about. That's
a horrible experience.
Right. And it's not private.
Correct. It's supposed to be where it's only you and the officer, but sometimes they're like thin, like shower stall walls. Like you could be in shower stalls. The next person's right there. You can see their feet. The officer's right there. Like mm-hmm. it's not a one-on-one majority of the time, not a one-on-one basis. Mm-hmm. They're not supposed to be able to see you. But the sounds are there. They can
right.
hear you. I mean,
you know
it's still, you know
on.
You're not alone.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So is your, I'm just amazed at the recovery that you've made and the work that you did on yourself in coming to grips with the idea that you're going to spend a long time in this place. How did that come about? Where did you find that?
How
strength
do you stay
to move
sane?
Forward?
Yeah. How do you stay sane?
Because it seems to me like you didn't sit around feeling sorry for yourself. It seems to me like what happened was you said, okay, I have to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and that comes just from my basic foundation. I would kind of think like, which also helped me commit the crime, bad, but is I can compartmentalize things. Like, I'm not a dweller. Mm-hmm. I don't dwell in what has happened in the past. I don't dwell in negative situations. I'm like, okay, this is happening. What can I do to get the best out of it? What mm-hmm. can I do to make the best? And as I was going through prison, and I worked in the law library, and coming across people who didn't have the background or the education or the experience or the knowledge or the perseverance or whatever you want to call it mm-hmm. to help move forward, or even reading their stories to help them to do their appeals. Something clicked to me and going, okay, but I can do this. Mm-hmm. And so don't dwell on what's happening to me. How do I move forward and make the best out of this experience? And I did a lot of soul searching. I mean, I did a lot of walking and thinking, and what do I need to fix? What do I need to improve? How did I get mm-hmm. to be here? And knowing that I haven't lost my family because of it, I still have my boys. I still have something to go home to,
right?
You know, and I couldn't let them down. I couldn't take 6 years out of my life, because that's what it was total, mm-hmm. and 6 years out of my children's lives and not have it mean something.
Yeah.
And so that's how I looked at it. I realized, okay, I need to finish my education because I want to get into something that helps pick an issue and improve on it. Mm-hmm. I say an issue because sometimes I would get a little overwhelmed going, okay, justice system needs fixed. The prison needs fixed. Okay, reentry needs fixed. Like when you start thinking of all the things that need fixed, it's mm-hmm. overwhelming. Mm-hmm. So I had to try to, okay, at this point, all I can do is fix myself and get the education I need. And then take it from there, find my passion, and start making the change.
And you found it. You found yeah. your passion, and you've moved forward. How was it when you... Do you have a question, Susan?
Well, I was wondering how that experience in the law library, particularly while you were working with other people who were working on their appeals, how did that inform the work that you're doing now?
I think it's the foundation, to be honest. Because I think if I went to prison, and I was very fortunate, like I said, that I had a working background. I had experience. I'd worked in the legal field. I had all that. Mm-hmm. So I could get pretty much the choice jobs. That helped. Mm-hmm. I wasn't one of them that was forced. Because when you go to prison, you're either programming or you're working. Or both. They don't allow you to do nothing and sit in your room. Like, that's not an option. You have to be doing one or the other. So I didn't have to go work at the kitchen. I didn't have to work as a janitor. I didn't have to do that. So luckily, my very first job was a law library. I had been there for 2 months, and when I was finally able to get in the right place and be able to work, I met with the supervisor there, formed a great connection with her, and got that job right away. And it helped me to learn about the appeal system, because I also was ignorant where that was going, where before that I was thinking, okay, if they're innocent, when they do their appeal, they'll get out. No. Once you've been found guilty, guilt and innocence does not matter. If something didn't go wrong at trial, if there was something that's technicality or any of that, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. You're innocent. That's why people finally with DNA after 20 some years are finally getting out.
Right.
Because guilt and innocence does not matter after that original trial.
Well, and from what I understand, that guilt and that charge follows you when you leave prison, so that reentry is inhibited severely when you're trying to get a job or a place to live. And I understand that. Are you working now with people who are in the process of reentry?
Well, yes and no. Yes. My experiences was, and you're absolutely right. I don't know if you remember the Scarlet Letter, but mm-hmm. that's pretty much what you have for the rest of your life. It never ends. Once you've been to prison and you're a felon, it never ends. Luckily, I know people hate the social justice arena now and the changes are making, but that's part of it. Like, did my time. I've changed. I've done it. I went mm-hmm. back to school. It shouldn't keep following me around, but it does. And I was ignorant when I got out. I'm going to use that word again. Lack of better choice.
It's a good word.
Is that I thought, okay, I have a working history. I shouldn't have a problem getting a job. Oh, it was hard. It was hard for even me. I mean, you can ask my family sometimes. I was breaking down. Aww. Like, oh my God, I couldn't even get a job at Amazon in the production. Like, what the heck? It's a production job. Why yeah. shouldn't I be able to do it? And it was very, very discouraging. And that was also one of the other factors that helped me to get back into going to school and mm-hmm. doing that too. But It is hard. Housing. People will be discriminated against for housing because they've been. They don't really care about any circumstances. You've changed or you've done that. If you've been to prison, you're already marked. And I've seen circumstances with housing is they're going to charge you 3 times a deposit than they will any other person. And so I was super, I'm going to tell you, I was fortunate. Like the first place I applied to, I was able to move into. But prior to that, to answer your question about helping people in reentry, I went to work. I mean, I went to, became a residential manager for a transitional house for women in Tacoma.
Mm-hmm.
It's called New Connections. Mm-hmm. And that was also another thing of eye opening to me is that it was, the women going into that house had no work history or they didn't know what to do and all of that. So trying to work with them and also finding it's even harder for them than it was for me because sure. I had family and friends.
And you knew how to do it. Mm-hmm. You knew how to apply for a job and where to look and what to say and how to appear.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so for me, it was discouraging enough. Believe me, there are times, I mean, luckily I'm a strong person and have a great support system, but there was times for me that I was going to go, I can't do this anymore. And so if I have a hard time, as tough as I am, for people who it's really hard, you can't get a job except for a minimum wage that's not going to help you get an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the apartment people telling you, no, but you okay, we'll let you in, but
you're going to pay.
You're going to pay for it. Yeah. You know, when you have those two things working, how do you expect people not to go back to what they know and what they're comfortable with?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it's okay or justifying it, but you can understand. And so society needs to understand that by rejecting them, you're just creating that vicious cycle.
Mm-hmm.
That if you instead support, help, reinforce, give them the jobs, give them the place to live, you're going to have a lot less crime and a lot less problems because people will now be able to thrive.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to just surviving and
correct.
Trying to figure it out what mm-hmm. the next step is. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there are glimmers of hope. And one of them I just learned about today is that I believe in Pennsylvania, the legislature has decided to use the term returning citizens instead of formerly incarcerated.
How do you feel about that?
Correct. Well, it's the whole idea of language and
right.
how language dictates the way people view someone who has had a prison experience mm-hmm. or committed a crime.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see language playing into the experience that folks have had coming out of prison in reentry?
And I think that the problem with the language is because people use it based on how they feel about the situation. I don't log words are words to me. Like, they only hurt you if you let them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, I use the term formerly incarcerated because I was. When I was going through my criminal law classes, I was very close to one of my, she was one of the instructors that also worked with me a lot. And she had me get a couple of my other formerly incarcerated people, and we did a little panel to try to inform the criminal justice classes of, you know, what it's like, the people getting mm-hmm. out of prison aren't ex-cons. This one woman, she's an older woman. I was trying to be nice about it. She kept saying ex-con. And I'm just saying, like, for some reason, that's a word that bothers me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not stuck on words, but for some reason, ex-con just has such a negative connotation with it.
It yeah. makes you conjure like, chain gangs and things.
Yeah. And so, like, I tried to gently teach her in a nice kind of like joking kind mm-hmm. of way to kind of inform her. But sometimes you may or may not be able to. And there's some people set in their ways. But I think mm-hmm. the verbiage you use shows how you perceive the situation.
True. True. And I think there's a matter of respect
correct.
For the individual mm-hmm. human, mm-hmm. you know, which how do you prefer to be addressed? How would you like me to say this?
Mm-hmm.
Because it can be hurtful to some people if they say the wrong thing, you know?
Correct.
Yeah. Well, and I do think language, whether it doesn't bother you, mm-hmm. The terminology that is used, that is applied to you and other folks who are reentering
mm-hmm.
Can determine how other people look at you,
mm-hmm.
can determine whether someone's going to be more amenable to the idea of you renting their apartment
right.
or working yeah. for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the idea that the Pennsylvania legislature was going after was to change attitudes about people
mm-hmm.
reentering. And this whole subject of reentry brings to mind to me, Dylan, your mom was gone for 6 years.
Yes.
Was there any difficulty? And if so, what was it when she returned home?
So I would go see her pretty frequently and, you know, we wrote letters and everything. I would say, honestly, the most difficult thing about any of it was after I would go see her and, you know, the fact that I can just leave and go home and be able to do whatever I want to do. And she has to go back to a cell. That part was really hard for me to deal with. But I mean, once she got out, it was kind of more so just, all right, like, let's move forward. What do we got to do to get back on track? You know, I remember one of the things, I talked to her on the phone a couple of weeks before she got out, and she asked me to help her set up an email address, and she asked me how much it's going to cost. And I told her, yeah, those don't really cost anymore. We got those. So.
Yeah.
But so it was just kind of, I mean, I guess for me, it wasn't really difficult in that it was just a goal that we had, you know, now we're in a different situation. Let's move forward. Let's figure it out. So, I mean, you know, everything that I could do to help her out. I mean, I tried to help her get jobs or, you know, she could stay at my place or whatever it was. So I don't know the difficult for me specifically was the issue, but I definitely can understand why that would be for a lot of people.
For some people, sure.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, even like she's touched on, some people don't have the support system around them, the infrastructure around them to where they can go back to anything. I mean, some people might not have anything to go back to. And then when everyone around you is, you know, breaking you down and telling you you're not good enough or you can't do this, I can definitely understand why it's very easy to just jump back into the same cycle. But so, I mean, for me, we choose to look at things in a positive outlook, you know, or we're goal oriented, you know. Yeah, it sucks that happened, but that's in the past. So let's move forward. How can we get better? How can we improve? What is it that we can do right now to make sure that the next moment is better than the moment before?
Wow.
And so that helps, honestly, tremendously, because then we don't dwell on the things. And it's just more so about moving forward and getting better and improving. And that's exactly what she's done. I mean, I can't explain to you how proud I am of my mom.
Aww.
She's so inspirational, so motivational. I mean, what she has done since she's been out, even before she was out, is just incredible. For anyone that's listening, I mean, it's anyone can do that. You know, just because you made one bad decision, it doesn't mean that your life is over. It doesn't mean that you can't still get back on track or that you don't have people that care. Like, it's just keep going, you know, never give up, never quit. Anything worth doing is going to be difficult. And once it's accomplished, it's well worth it. So,
Gee, Dylan, have you ever considered the priesthood?
Well, he's definitely his mother's son. He's definitely his mother's son. Yeah. So, Deb, for you, aside from the job search, how was reentry? What did that feel like for you to come out and be free? Yeah,
the little things that surprised you.
You know, it's like, it's amazing because 6 years to some may not sound like a lot, but when you're talking about a huge chunk of technology change,
that was
a big thing. Like before I went in, they were just finally getting to, like, from flip phones to phones that you can actually maybe get a little bit of internet on. I remember my youngest son, when I got out and I was at work release and we went to McDonald's, and first that was freaky because the board was moving. I'm like, hey, how am I supposed to be able to see this? I'm like, when does it stop? And the prices, like, wow, when I went in, I think the prices of a Happy Meal doubled, you know? But then he buys it and they give him a receipt and we go out and he throws it in the garbage. And I'm like, don't you need to put that in your checkbook? He starts laughing at me and he pulls out his phone and he shows me his bank statement. He's like, here, it's already there. Like, wait, what? So entrusting that. I mean, because I come from a generation, my birthday was on Sunday, I just turned 56. And so I come from a different generation of where you do a checkbook and you do all of that. You don't trust the internet. You don't trust giving your information there. You don't do that. To now, to where, okay, man, my life was so hard before and I didn't even realize it. Like the maps. Oh my God, I love maps on my phone.
Yeah. Like,
it just makes life so much easier. You just don't realize. So
GPS.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm even the woman that I'm working with on clemency here. You know, when she gets out after 33 years, there was technology when she went in.
Yeah.
Oh my it's going to be a shock for her that I'm going to kind of enjoy working with her on it.
Watching her walk through it all.
So those are like some of the little things, just all of that little stuff.
And good food.
Yes. Yes. You do learn a different value of food. I think that I've also, I mean, not that I haven't put on a lot of weight with this, you know, I'm blaming COVID and working remotely on the weight gain.
Okay. Me too.
So just on that, because that is the difference. I think prison also taught me food wise is just food is just meant to nourish your body. Like not to, because my son asked me all the time, Dylan asked me, so what do you want to eat? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't care. And he's like, that's kind of really annoying, you know, when you're trying to figure it out. But for me, it's like, I don't have a, I feel like this. Oh, I feel like that. Because I just kind of learned to disassociate with food. Mm-hmm. Like, I like it. I like to eat it. And I like the flavor. But nothing sounds wonderful most of the time.
Because so it's not a pleasurable experience for you. Was it before you went into prison? Were you a foodie? Were you into food before you went into prison?
I mean, I think I've always enjoyed food. But, I mean, I think I had more favorites, more, you know, rathers. But, like, spaghetti used to be a favorite of mine. But once you've had spaghetti in prison, that can really change your palate.
Yeah, it was. So the first thing that she wanted when she got out, I asked her, you know, what kind of meal do you want with food, River? And it was like a big gulp of Diet Dr. Pepper from 7-Eleven. Okay, well, after we get that, then what do you want to do? Because we can do that anywhere. Mm-hmm. What else?
Well, she was living in a pretty tiny world.
Yeah, so that was a lot to
controlled
her.
Controlled and tiny world,
That was striking to me when you mentioned the woman who's been in for 33 years. It occurred to me then that, well, things aren't changing in prison. Nothing is. Mm-hmm. Prison remains the same. They don't provide any access to the internet or any updates on how to live in the world. It's all prescribed for you. Mm-hmm. And it all remains the same year after year after year.
And it's all predicated on punishment as opposed to education or moving forward, handy tools to use psychologically.
Or rehabilitation, if you will.
Right, right.
And that was a video I had watched one of my friends that, actually, she's on the Lived Experience Advisory, and then she also is one of, she also works for Civil Survival. And she had sent a link to, and I can't remember off the top of my head, but it was showing, it was a little YouTube video too of showing a men's prison, like Attica, I think it was, showing, having these men see, it was interviewing some men there, and then it was interviewing men in a Swedish prison. And how completely 100% different. Mm-hmm. Because they don't take a punishment stance over there.
Right.
They take a, rehabilitation stance. And so these, like, these guys are able to fix their own meals. Mm-hmm. They're able to, they live in like a housing kind of environment. And they have a lot less crime over there. Because they take that stance rather than punishment. Where the United States is a purely 100% punishment that will be there for the rest of your life.
Period.
Period.
Yeah.
You are now a horrible individual.
Yeah.
Where other countries don't always have that stance.
It's
they
inhumane.
See it as rehabilitation. Because to me, common sense on this issue is, who do you want releasing as your neighbor? Someone who is going to have a job, or someone who's going to find housing, who's going to do that? Or do you want your neighbor releasing someone who has nothing to gain, can't get a job, can't get anything, and goes back to what they know? Because that's, they have to survive. You have to eat. You have to feed your family.
Well,
you know,
that's a common thread that domestic violence victims have as well. Mm-hmm. They don't leave. I mean, the pain is familiar. That where they are is familiar, and it's scary to move forward.
Kind of a prison.
Yeah, in a way. Sure. Deb, I want to talk to you, or have you talk to us, about the Lived Experience Advisory Team. Okay. Tell me more about who you are. Can you tell us who you are and what you're doing specifically?
It's a relatively newer organization. We started probably 4 or 5 months ago, I think, is when we started having our first meeting. And on this is, it's like you mentioned, it's led by Jeannie Darnell. It's still hard for me not to call her Senator, because that's what
Senator
I'm used to.
Oh, Senator Darnell.
Well, you still can, that's why I have, because I actually met her originally while I was in prison.
Oh.
And I was working with her and Tara Simmons and a few other people on trying to write make additions to the FOSA bill. So
for those of you who don't know, Tara Simmons.
As Tara Simmons is the first nationwide formerly incarcerated representative, actually
right.
any elected office.
Yeah.
In that kind of format. And so it's she had to go in front of the Supreme Court to be even allowed to take the bar. Even when she got out, she went to law school, but they weren't going to allow her to take the bar because she had been formerly incarcerated, and she had to go to the Supreme Court to get that. So she had to go to the Supreme Court to even be allowed to take the bar because they're sanctioned, which doesn't make sense to me.
So did this come about through a brainstorming session or through... Jeannie's passion, where did it...
Well, I think it came a lot through Jeannie's passion. First, because she has all along, since I've known her for the last 7-8 years or whatever, she's always been into prison reform. Mm-hmm. She's always been into social justice issues. And I think that's benefited her as a senator, people being able to come to her with new ideas. And so knowing what she was like, when Cheryl Strange became the superintendent or the secretary of the prisons, she looked at it. She was also more open-minded than the prior one, and we won't get into that.
Okay.
I did not care for him at all. But so she's more open-minded, too, to understand where Jeannie had talked to her about there's a difference between men's prison and women's prisons, and you need to treat the women's prisons differently.
Okay.
The gender issues. It's a gender subject. Mm-hmm. Because, obviously, as mentioned, men don't have the problem with periods and that kind of stuff. And that's just minute compared to the whole experience. And so she appointed... Jeannie had retired early, stepped out of being a senator and went on because she then got hired as assistant to the secretary of the prisons in the women's division, a newly created division, the women's divisions.
Okay.
And so as they brainstormed and they did this study on what makes the women's prisons different, it's like this 100 and some page thing, pamphlet or something. Like, I can be honest, I haven't read it all because it's boring. But that being said, so she said that who best to determine what changes need to be made but people who have been incarcerated. I mean, you can walk through a prison, but you're not going to know what's right or wrong or lived experience. And, and I know they said, oh, we're going to have a tour. So we knew we had to clean everything up. We knew things are not going to be how they really are.
So as an outsider, I'm not going to see the real thing when I come in.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Because they want to make it look good to people.
Well, sure they do. Of course they do. Mm-hmm. So what is your outreach like with this organization?
So currently there's no real outreach on this. We are just meeting and trying to...
You're figuring it out.
Yeah, we're still trying to figure the organization itself. At this point... She's got a lot of knowledge from us on things that, so she goes back and meets with DOC.
Right.
And DOC has this opinion or the thought on how things get done. And so they're listening to us going, okay, wait, maybe.
But wait a minute.
So, and she's willing to fight for us.
Okay.
That's what makes the difference. We don't have a wimpy person, with lack of better terms, that's going to say, okay, you're right, they're wrong, you know, to them, and telling them that they're right. No, no, this makes sense.
Yeah.
This is how it should be done. And you could not have picked a better person to run the women's division.
And so can those changes come through the prison system, or does this have to be legislative?
Combination of. I mean, it's going to depend on whether it's being ran by RCW, WIAC, then it would have to be legislation. But if it's going to be like simple little food choices inside the prison, that can
be
them. They've made slow changes. I mean, COVID also helped the prisons. Is when I was there, there's only a room for 700 and some people, and they had 900 and some there. So we were way overcrowded. Now they're down to under 600.
Oh, okay.
And so because COVID, they made a lot of releases. Yeah. I also was in the baby program. So I was in the unit that mothers that were pregnant that had less than 3 years left could come and stay there and have their baby.
Let's talk about the babies and the children in the prison system. What happens to them? If I'm a mom and I have to go for 5 years... for whatever it is I did, and I have a 2- and a 3-year-old.
And if you have no family members or no one that can take them, they go into the foster system.
Okay.
And in the foster system, they have a, and let me see if I can remember, I can't remember the exact breakdown, what the term is, but there's an actual act that states that if they have been in the foster system for 15 out of the last 22 months, then the parents have to sign away their rights. And so
I can't get over that.
So it's a forced situation where regardless, you're the only person who cares for your kids and you love your kids and you've made a stupid mistake. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter. You will lose the rights. And that's a thing that really, and they don't, I can't say whether they care or don't care, but it isn't a factor that you're in prison mm-hmm. and that's why they're in the foster system. That's not a factor of it. The foundation of this, the theory behind this was that kids shouldn't spend their whole life in the foster system. So in theory, that sounds
great. Which is
great.
True. And in theory,
but if their mother's in prison and going to be getting out, that should be a whole different scenario, but it's not. That's not a factor into it.
And so then the moms, when they get out, can't see their kids.
Correct. I mean, I don't know if there's, at this point, I don't know if there's a way to reunification.
Well, there might
but I think
some,
it's something that needs to be happened, to needs to start while they're in prison,
mm-hmm.
to find a reunification and not help, not have them sign the rights away. And I think there may be some changes or some things that have been done since then. I'm not positive.
So when you
but
say
that is
sign
a whole,
their,
oh, sorry.
I'm sorry.
Go
when
ahead.
You say sign their rights away, are you saying they are relinquishing the rights to their children? They are put up for adoption?
Correct.
Yes.
They're, so the foster system is a little different from, I mean, that's kind of a holding pattern for adoption.
Correct.
But that once they're in the foster system, then they are eligible to be adopted. Is that?
Correct.
They're taken away.
Basically, yes.
Yeah.
If they've been in the foster system for 15 months out of the last 22 months, they can be adopted out. The parents are required to sign the rights away and they can be adopted out. And I'm not saying that happens every time, but that's the way the statute reads.
That is horrifying.
And it's happened a lot while I was in there. Yeah. I had women that were crying to me, very frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I'm in there. I can't help out. I don't know what the laws are.
Right. Well, we're running down close to the end of the show. And I wonder if you could speak to how can a normal person out here in the world help when we don't know? Where do we look to get educated? Mm-hmm. How do we find a place maybe that we can contribute to or some measure of help for women in prison?
Well, there's a couple organizations that, like the IF Project is one that Kimbo Gookie has started. She's a detective for the Seattle Police Department, and she started this project for helping with women that are in prison, finding mentors and helping that kind of situation.
And so we would look up, they have a website.
The IF Project, yes.
And it's called the IF Project.
If
like what if this, what if that,
and that was basically how she started the foundation. Mm-hmm. When she had a first classroom, she came up with if someone would have said something different to change the trajectory of your life, what would that have been?
Wow,
that's interesting.
And so that's why it's called
the
IF Project.
Yeah,
she's an amazing person. And then there's also like locally, sort of in mm-hmm. Gig Harbor area, Gig Harbor Rotary, the Rotary Reentry Program is one mm-hmm. that went into the prisons.
Well, here on Vashon Island, we have the Vashon Mori chapter of Showing Up for Racial Justice Surge,
right.
And that organization has a specific criminal justice system action team. You can get in touch with Janie Starr in order to learn more about that. I'm trying to remember her email address. But anyway, you can go to Vashon Mori Surge and they have
S-U-R-J
mm-hmm. Facebook page, mm-hmm. but that's very local. And yes, Gig Harbor is another.
So really, if we want to help, we figure out what area, like, do I want to be a mentor to a young woman that's coming out of prison, or do I want to teach some classes or do some, I don't know what it would be.
You want to help on reentry? Like,
yeah. So you sort of pick what it is you think you want to contribute.
Correct.
And then find the place that you can help.
The internet is amazing. You can Google anything.
Look what you discovered.
I know. Yes, I mean, and you can. Like, if you have a thought, women releasing from prison, put that in there, and it will tell you organizations that will help you.
So much. So I just want to say thank you so much to both of you for coming. It meant a lot, and we didn't get nearly everything talked about that we wanted to, but you've been wonderful guests and I thank you from my heart. You're meaningful people, and the things that you had to say and share with us are very important, and thank you for taking your time to come and see us.
Yeah, thank you for having us. I really appreciate
very
the opportunity.
Enlightening. Thank you all.
Yes.
This was really
so
wonderful.
Wonderful. Did you get an email address?
And this is the Clatch.
Oh yeah, we're closing. This is the Clatch. We have to go now. And there we go. We will see you next time, which will be in 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
2 weeks. We'll see you then. Thank you so much for listening.